Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When disaster strikes a place, whether it's man-made or natural, what motivates outsiders to stream in with money and resources? Conventional wisdom tells us first responders to catastrophic events are noble and generous, interested chiefly in providing relief to innocent victims. But those first responders are often followed or even accompanied by people and organizations with different motives. Resort developers who bought up land destroyed by the Indonesian tsunami, oil companies eager for a share of Iraq's petroleum wealth, and urban planners convinced that a New Orleans purged of poor residents might be a better place for tourists and wealthy homeowners alike. So what happens to all that aid for stricken people, and what role do the World Bank and the IMF play? Naomi Klein examines those questions in her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. It was a New York Times bestseller soon after publication last year and has just been re-released in a paperback edition. Naomi, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
You say that disaster capitalism often plays out as a sort of three-strike attack. Can you explain that?
Well, the thesis for this book came out of my reporting in Iraq, after the invasion, and what I write is that Iraq was subjected to three distinct forms of shock that mutually reinforced each other. The first was the shock of the war itself that prepared the ground for this attempt to turn the country into a kind of ideological utopia for the Bush administration. And if we cast our minds back to the year that Paul Bremer was in charge of Iraq, the sort of swagger of that year when immediately on his arrival he declared Iraq open for business, passed about 100 new economic laws that made Iraq actually the widest open economy in the world. The Economist magazine called it a capitalist dream. And this way of remaking a country very, very quickly, taking it from one system to another, to a so-called free market system, is called by economists economic shock therapy. So first came the shock and awe invasion. It was immediately followed by economic shock therapy. And the idea, I quote Richard Armitage, the Undersecretary of State, saying that the idea was that the shock and awe invasion would create a situation where Iraqis would be easily marshaled from point A to point B. So the idea was that these two shocks would work in tandem. But of course, that didn't work. Iraqis resisted many of the U.S. attempts to remake their country along these very ideological lines. And then there was a third shock, which was the attempt to sort of regain the country, and that was much less metaphorical. It was the shock of torture. So those are the three shocks that I discuss.
And you talk about shock therapy because these shocks are actually intended to sort of completely break down the way things have been done and then rebuild it from scratch.
Well, economic shock therapy, you know, this is a term that economists use, and we've heard it now for several decades. It was first used actually in the 70s. In Latin America, Milton Friedman, the famed free market economist, gave advice to the dictator, Augusto Pinochet, in 1975, telling him that he should push through a kind of tsunami of pro-corporate laws, and he referred to it as the shock treatment approach and said only the shock approach will do. He used that phrase many times in his advice to Pinochet and in his public statements. I think the theory behind economic shock is that all of these new laws will reinforce each other. But there's also a political strategy to it, which is that if you throw all of these changes at a society at once, particularly when there has just been a crisis, in the case of Chile, it was a coup, and if we think about Russia in the 90s, which was another classic economic shock therapy, this was a country that was in a period of dramatic political transition where people didn't even really know what country they were living in because it had been the Soviet Union, now it was Russia, things were changing so quickly. And it was in that window of dislocation that, as you mentioned in your introduction, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all these think tanks move in and push for the economic shock therapy. So the idea is that people won't be able to resist change at this speed, and they will also be focused on the day-to-day emergencies. I mean, certainly when I was in Iraq, during the first year of the occupation, Iraqis were focused on their daily emergencies. They were focused on feeding their families. They were focused on whether they were going to be able to find work. They were focused on the latest bombing, they couldn't focus on the laws that Paul Bremer was passing through, was pushing through. And I think that that needs to be recognized as a strategy. It's precisely because people are distracted that these moments of shock, these moments of crisis, are such great opportunities to push through really unpopular policies.
Naomi Klein is my guest. Her book is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. With regard to Iraq being open for business, Naomi, it's important to point out, you write that some of the functions that particularly oil companies are performing there in terms of the services that they're performing are not things that the Iraqis couldn't do for themselves.
Well, just in recent months, of course, we've heard about these no-bid contracts that have been awarded to the oil majors. What's significant about these contracts is that they are service agreements, which means that they're actually jobs that are usually performed not by a company like Shell or Texaco, but by companies like Halliburton, who specialize in servicing oil fields. And the significance of them being handed to the oil majors, who don't actually do this work themselves and have already said that they're going to contract it out to Iraqis, which begs the question of why you need the oil majors in the first place, is that it's sort of a two-stage process. They're being given the option later on down the road once there is an oil law, and this is one of the things that hasn't happened in Iraq, is they don't yet have a national oil law, that when there is a law in place and the real prizes start to be handed out, which are, of course, the exploration deals and taking over Iraq's largest oil fields, then these companies who came in with the service contracts will get the sort of right of first refusal on those big contracts. So that's the significance of what's going on right now.
What sort of money is there in reconstruction these days? What we call reconstruction of disaster areas?
Well, one of the things that I've been tracking is all the functions that used to be performed by nonprofits, by NGOs, by the UN, that are now seen as part of this new, what I'm calling the disaster capitalism complex. So, I mean, I could throw out some numbers. We know in Iraq the reconstruction was worth $30 billion. That's around the amount of money that was allocated both from Congress and Iraq's oil. $8 billion to reconstruct Lebanon after the Israeli air attack. So, obviously, it depends on the disaster or the war and the level of destruction that was caused, and also the level of political will. But I think the significance is less the dollar amount for each disaster and more the fact that these functions that used to be performed without a profit margin built in are now being done for a profit. I was really struck by a story last summer about how in Peru after an earthquake, the role of building the camps for the internally displaced people, which had always been performed by the UN, was being performed by an American company that had cut its teeth in the prison sector in the United States, which is another frontier for privatization, Aramark. So the reason why I'm calling it the disaster capitalism complex as opposed to the military industrial complex or some of these other phrases is that it's not restricted to war. It expands into any crisis situation. And in fact, natural disasters are seen as a real growth industry for these private companies. So if you look at a company like Blackwater, they really cut their teeth in Iraq, and this is where they really built their reputation, such as it is, or their lack of reputation. But if we look at where Blackwater sees their next frontier, their new areas of growth, We know that they showed up in New Orleans. I was in New Orleans after the levees broke, and Blackwater was there saying, you know, we're filling in the gap because the police aren't doing their job. So they see natural disasters as a way to diversify from war zones, and they also see border control as an area where they can diversify. So anything that creates a sort of state of panic, a state of emergency, is a growth industry for these companies.
So it may be a growth industry, but clearly these are things that are risky for any kind of investor. What makes these disaster areas so appealing to companies like Halliburton and Blackwater? Why are they willing to take on that risk?
Well, you know, frankly, they're actually not that risky from a corporate perspective. They're certainly risky from an employee perspective. For the workers who go in there, they're taking on, you know, an enormous personal risk to their safety, and their families are taking on an enormous risk. And we don't even know how many of the employees of these private companies have died in Iraq, for instance. We heard About 900 contractors had died in Iraq, and that figure's a year old, and it's not kept track of in the same way as soldier casualties are kept track of. But from the corporate perspective, there's very little risk because, of course, these are the cost plus contracts. The companies have a guarantee that they're going to get their costs recovered plus a built-in profit. And there's been, of course, many corruption scandals where companies have tried to get that profit margin increased. But it's impossible for them to actually lose money because they have a guarantee, precisely because these are such risky situations. That this is, and this, I think, begs the question of, you know, whether this really is a free market at all, or whether it should even be described as capitalism, because it's really public money that's being handed out to private firms, and in many cases the contracts are no bid, so it doesn't really meet any of the criteria of what we would classically think of as a competitive free market.
One of the things, the World Bank today spends nearly a quarter of its money in post-conflict countries. Can you talk about how that money is typically allocated?
Well, this has been a real shift for the multilateral lenders like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Of course, their roots date back to the Reconstruction from the Second World War, the Bretton Woods institutions. But in the 80s and 90s, the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund was primarily in the context of countries that were facing a debt crisis, a financial crisis, and they would very famously move in and offer countries economic bailouts in exchange for conditions. And those conditions that were called structural adjustment, and all over Africa and Latin America, the phrase structural adjustment took on very, very negative connotations as a kind of legalized blackmail because countries were in such a desperate state that they couldn't say no to demands that, for instance, they privatize their water system or build some mega project which dislocated many people and where there was a great deal of local opposition. Now, disasters, conflicts, and also natural disasters are ways that the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are gaining a new legitimacy, and I think it's important to understand that these institutions are really in a crisis of their own. The World Bank, for instance, we know is facing a crisis of legitimacy. More and more countries don't want to deal with them. The International Monetary Fund has been forced to lay off workers, hundreds of workers, forced to sell some of their gold because they are facing a financial crisis of their own. And interestingly, these institutions are seeing a new life for themselves, actually in the context less of war than of climate change. And the fact that after a country's been hit by a hurricane, a devastating flood, particularly if the country's already indebted, they will do whatever it takes to secure reconstruction funding. And now that funding is coming with the same conditions that used to come with the structural adjustment loans of the 90s.
So, in other words, the World Bank says it's not stable enough for you to control the money yourselves. We're going to keep an eye on exactly how it's spent, even though we're lending it to you.
Well, yeah, and I think a classic example of that, precisely that situation, would be East Timor, which really became a kind of World Bank protectorate. I mean, they were completely in charge of the finances of the country. Another would be Liberia.
Naomi Klein is my guest. Her book is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll talk more about the climate change crisis and how that may affect disaster capitalism in the future.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Naomi Klein. Her newest book, just re-released in paperback, is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. It's almost hard to believe that this is an industry, Naomi, but something else that has arisen out of this phenomenon has been this thing called the democracy building industry. Can you talk about what that encompasses?
Well, the democracy building industry or democracy promoting industry is part of the NGO arm of this complex. And I think a lot of it is very well-meaning and is often quite positive. And what I look at in the book, though, is the way in which a country is being subjected to what I'm calling the shock doctrine, where you have the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, sometimes the U.S. Treasury, pushing for economic reforms that really change the kind of country that this is going to be, that pushes, for instance, Haiti would be an example, where there was a really clear agenda to push for privatization of education and health care. And at the same time, you have the democracy promoters coming in to strengthen so-called civil society. And these groups are really working parallel to one another. And so the question that I think needs to be looked at closely in this context is, how is democracy really being defined? Because if you are telling people on the one hand how important self-determination is, how important democracy is, and at the same time they're watching these foreign experts decide these key issues that in so many countries are, particularly in developing world countries, are key to national identity, are key victories of anti-colonial struggles, the right to control their natural resources, to regain control over natural resources like oil, minerals from foreign interests and having them controlled by the countries themselves. So the message that I look at in the book is this idea that economics has to be handled by technocrats, by experts, and something like privatization of essential services or natural resources is actually, the message is that this is not really a political decision at all. It's strictly a technocratic economic decision, which I don't think is true at all, that actually people see this as core to their democracies. And at the same time, the democracy promoters are saying, well, it's very, very important that you vote, and it's very, very important that you have civil liberties, but when you have democracy, you won't be able to affect the economy. So it's simultaneously promoting democracy, but also limiting democracy, limiting the reach of democracy, making it very weak so that it can't reach into the economic sphere.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to John in Dallas. Hello, John.
Hi, Chris and Naomi. I don't know if you noticed, but a few months ago, Bill Moyers ran a little survey on his journal program saying, what one book should the next president read other than the Bible? And The Shock Doctrine was the most popular book recommended on the blog. It wasn't the majority, but it was the most popular book recommended on the blog. Just a fun fact there. But my main question is, how much of this connection between the institutions that support, you know, coming after disaster, how much of it is contrived versus random, meaning how much of this is set up by governments and corporations to intentionally set up situations to where then the money people can come in and make their shocking, you know, benefit from the change from the shock versus just having, you know, this set up kind of more randomly. So, okay, there's going to be a disaster here, we'll go do this, and it's set up for us. But how much of the disasters or the changes in governments actually set up on purpose?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great question, and in the book, I really resist the urge to give in to conspiracy theories. I don't think it is a grand conspiracy, but I think there are some really clear trends and interests that we can identify, and patterns that have repeated again and again. And I think that this is precisely the significance of it being an industry, a sort of global, I call it the global green zone or the roving green zone, because, you know, in Iraq you can see it really graphically because there is this geographical space and that is necessary because of the security situation, where you have this walled city within a city where everyone is based, right? The democracy promoters and the private security firms and the reconstruction firms, everyone is working out of this same space. What I say in the book is the green zone isn't a place, it's a state of mind, it is this roving industry, and it touches down now wherever the next disaster strikes, and there is this sameness to it. I mean, I was so struck when I was in New Orleans after the levees broke to see the same Baghdad Pack, the Halliburton, Bechtel, Blackwater, just slipping in there and performing the same roles that they had played in Iraq. So I think that once the market has been created, then the logic of capitalism just sets in, and you keep looking for new market opportunities, and it replicates itself, if that makes sense.
You have been a strong critic of a lot of elements of globalization on different fronts. Do you think, Naomi, that this problem, in fact, is worse and more severe when it happens with a corporation that comes from some other part of the world than when it might happen on a smaller scale, sort of regionally?
Well, I think there are inherent problems to anything where there's a huge amount of distance between where decisions are made and where the effects of decisions are felt. So, I think that a global company like Halliburton in Iraq creates its own set of problems. This isn't to say that Iraqi firms don't have their own corruption problems. Of course they do. But I think what creates the frustration around these global firms is, first of all, the sense of a kind of a foreign takeover and an insult to national identity, which can be very inflammatory, but also just a sense of a feeling of helplessness about how do you affect a company whose headquarters are so far away. And I saw this when I was living in Argentina in 2002, making a documentary film, and the water had been privatized, and it was a French company called Suez that was doing the work, and they had put in the water pipes, but they had forgotten to put in the sewers, and every time it rained, there would be these huge floods. This is in the suburbs of Buenos Aires, and there was just such an incredible level of frustration for people because they did not know who to appeal to. They didn't know how to reach this company that was based in Paris. So I think that there is something unique about the globalness of these companies, yeah.
So aside even from Hurricane Katrina, there are other places where this could affect us domestically. For example, the rising price of oil now and the apparent constriction in the supply of available oil.
Yeah, absolutely. And, what I'm looking at in the book is the ways in which unpopular policies, policies that you couldn't push through during normal circumstances precisely because they are so contentious, like water privatization, slip through in moments of panic, in moments of crisis. And I look at a range of crises that play this this enabling role. The most dramatic case is the one we started with, the invasion of Iraq, the shock and awe invasion. But there can be smaller shocks that play this same readying role. And I think we're living through a shock doctrine moment right now with the oil shock, with the shock at the pump of the price of gas and people being desperate for any kind of relief. And in that moment of crisis, we have been treated to a very organized campaign funded by the oil and gas industry to sell a solution to this real crisis, which is to drill offshore, to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, to drilling other contentious exploration like shale. And this is really the wish list of the oil and gas industry. These are areas that they weren't able to open up without a crisis. And in this moment of crisis, we're seeing I don't think it really is a solution. There seems to be an incredible level of agreement, even from the people who are pushing these policies, that actually this isn't going to impact the price at the pump anytime soon. But the point is that in a crisis, people are willing to accept even false promises, even the false promise of a solution.
1-800.
We've seen public opinion shift quite dramatically in favor of offshore oil drilling in the face of this campaign.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Keith in Garland asks, regarding the disaster capitalism, what organization has oversight for the missing billions of unaccounted monies? And in Iraq or after Katrina, has anyone been held to task?
That's a great question. And I wish there was a great answer for it. I think we've certainly seen some attempts to get some accountability. Henry Waxman has launched some really important investigations. I think the belligerence of the Bush administration in terms of cooperating with these probes, we've seen it in many areas, and we see it here too. It's possible that there won't be any accountability until there's a new administration, and even then, I would be a little worried about the commitment of the Democrats in this area. I've been disappointed that Barack Obama hasn't made this issue, which is such actually a populist issue, the fact that so much public money has been wasted in the name of reconstruction in New Orleans, in Iraq. This is not actually a tough issue to sell to the public. People are already very angry about it, very alarmed about it, but this hasn't become an election issue. Because Barack Obama has not turned it into one, and it could easily be one.
Let's talk about what happened after the tsunami. The world's attention was on that part of the world, and there was a lot of aid promised. In addition to NGOs and sort of donated money that went in, a lot of for-profit companies went. And there were many people who argued that their presence would at least put people back to work, and it would put real dollars in a place and create an incentive for making sure that the repairs continued. What actually happened?
Well, the country that I studied most closely was Sri Lanka. I went to Sri Lanka 6 months after the tsunami hit. And Sri Lanka was one of the hardest hit countries, not as hard hit as Indonesia, as Aceh, but 40,000 people were killed, and about half a million people were internally displaced, lost their homes. Overwhelmingly, the people who lost their homes and livelihoods and family members to the tsunami in Sri Lanka were small boat fishing people, because this is who lives on the coast, and so when a huge wave comes and wipes the coast clean, it's going to be the fishing people who are hardest hit. What I saw happening in Sri Lanka was that, well, first of all, the government, with pressure from international lenders, had passed a law called the buffer zone law, which made it illegal for the fishing people who had lost their homes and their boats and their fishing equipment to the tsunami. It made it illegal for them to rebuild within 200 meters from the water, which is where most of them had lived before. But they weren't given other plots of land nearby, so they just had nowhere to live, and they were being held in these inland camps. Now, the reason for the buffer zone, the public reason given was safety, was that what if another wave came? It was too dangerous for them to rebuild. And what I saw happening was a huge amount of construction taking place inside the buffer zone, while the former residents of this area were being warehoused in these inland camps, and the construction was large resorts, luxury resorts, and also industrial fishing fleets. So a transition from small boat fishing to these sort of mega fleets. And I guess the problem with this, And the argument is just as you said. The argument was that this was better for economic development. These were small-scale fisheries. Now they would have large-scale fisheries. I interviewed somebody from the Asian Development Bank, their senior economist, and they said, look, these fishing people weren't contributing very much to economic growth, which is true. They were only supporting themselves and their families. They were subsistence fishing people. The World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the U.S. State Department all saw this as an opportunity to move from that kind of small-scale economic activity to something larger scale with foreign investment. The problem was that the people who would be hired by the tourism sector were not the same people who had lost their homes. So all of this money had been raised in the name of the victims of the tsunami, and not only wasn't it going to them, but it was actually going to displace them. And this created a huge amount of tension, anger, jealousy. There was a sense that everybody else was getting the aid money but you. And what I argue in the book is that there's actually a great deal of evidence that this contributed in Sri Lanka to to a return to civil war because of these tensions. And actually, some of the earliest attacks were on aid workers.
Clearly, no corporation or government or NGO is sitting around waiting for something of this magnitude to happen. For one thing, it would be unrealistic. It would be a bad business model, despite the morals of everything. But you did discover that the U.S. has post-conflict plans for, what, a couple of dozen regions of the world.
Yeah, that this is part of the State Department now, under Condoleezza Rice, and, you know, you mentioned that I have been a critic of globalization and more broadly. And I think that the fact that there is this political interest now at the State Department, at the World Bank, at the International Monetary Fund in post-conflict reconstruction, even in countries that haven't experienced the conflict yet. You're describing an office that creates plans to reconstruct countries that haven't been destroyed yet. So, for instance, if there's a conflict in Venezuela or Cuba, then there's already a plan on the books to go in there. And the reason why I raise the, you know, the debates about globalization is that I think we have to see this in the context of a broader crisis of imposing many of these economic policies without a conflict, through a consensual process. You know, the Doha round of the World Trade Organization talks has just collapsed a couple of weeks ago. As I said earlier, the International Monetary Fund is in crisis because so many countries won't deal with them anymore because they have such a destructive track record. So this is why I think we need to understand disaster capitalism in this context, that many of the policies that used to be imposed through free trade agreements, through the International Monetary Fund or the World Trade Organization, can no longer be imposed this way because there is so much popular dissent, and now they're sneaking in under the banner of reconstruction.
Naomi Klein is with us. Her latest book is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. You can get on the line now to join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Naomi Klein. Her latest book is called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. You can also find her online at naomiklein.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Larray in Dallas. Hi, Larray.
Hi. I was interested in hearing Naomi's comments about something a friend of mine who's worked for decades supplying relief to conflict and war-torn areas. And she said that she feels like NGOs have become a part of the system, of the disaster capitalism. In other words, these conflicts emerge in countries, and that's not excluding the U.S., depend on compassionate people being there to supply basic needs to people, such as shelter, medical care, and food. And what that's created is a greater disparity between the people and those who make political decisions.
What do you think, Naomi?
Well, you know, I found the same thing in everywhere from New Orleans to the tsunami-affected regions in Asia, where the people working for the NGOs are actually the harshest critics of themselves, because these are people who overwhelmingly are driven by a humanitarian instinct, want to do everything that they can to help, often putting themselves at real risk to do so, but are seeing themselves a part of, really in an impossible situation. So if we come back to the tsunami, just to keep this concrete, you had those camps that I was describing, which are where people who had lost their homes and their livelihoods were being held and taken care of. And the NGOs, like Oxfam, Save the Children, they were in charge of those camps, and they were doing whatever they could to make people's lives more comfortable, giving them water, building shelters. But yet at the same time, they are watching this political situation unfold where while they are keeping people fed and housed, their land is being handed out to, is really being stolen from under them. At the same time, the NGOs are in a really difficult political situation because they're only in the country with the permission of the government. So what I found when I interviewed people, for instance, working for Oxfam, they were saying that they wished that they could speak out against these land grabs, and speak for the people they were trying to help in a political way, not just in in the context of aid, but to look at the bigger political picture. But they said that if they did that, they'd get kicked out of the country. So what I'm trying to do with the book is not to point any fingers, and I think the most dangerous thing we could do would be to become very, very cynical about the whole idea of aid, and the next time there's a disaster, just think, well, I'm not even going to try to help because it'll probably do more harm than good. That's the last message that I want people to take from this. But yet we do need to identify some structural problems and try to put some solutions in place.
An email from a listener in Dallas says, I can see that it is a total abuse to use economic shock therapy to remake a country for the benefit of outsiders who want to gain wealth at the expense of the country being remade. But surely there are cases when a people might choose economic shock therapy as the most likely method of accomplishing what they want. Have you heard of examples like that?
Absolutely. The book is really, it's kind of an alternative history of the past 35 years of how this particular free market model has come to dominate around the world. And by free market, I'm really talking about this sort of extreme shock therapy model that was imposed in Russia in the 90s and what was attempted in Iraq. Not a mixed economy, not a balance between the public and private sector, but this extreme version. And I look at many different examples of this, and I guess the closest example of what that listener was just talking about would be Poland in 1989. This was the first Eastern Bloc country to have elections and to get out from under the thumb of Moscow. And it was greeted as around the world as a tremendous political victory. This is the 1989 elections that brought the party of Lech Walesa to power, Solidarity. And the problem with that political victory is that it was bittersweet because Poland was in an economic crisis. It needed a huge amount of international aid. There were terrible shortages, bread lines, and so on. So there was a crisis as well as a political victory. And Poland was the first Eastern Bloc country to embrace the economic shock therapy route. And the leadership in Solidarity did embrace it, precisely on this promise that even though it would be painful, it was the shortest route to becoming part of normal Europe. And that's the way these policies were sold. The problem is that if we really think about what normal Europe is, and certainly what it was in 1989, if we think about West Germany and France, these are countries with a very strong social safety net. These are countries which are not radical Milton Friedman style free market economies. They're countries that are really trying to balance having some parts of their economy in the public sector, like education and healthcare and unemployment insurance and strong unions, and also having a free market in consumer goods. So it was really a false promise that was sold to the leadership of Solidarity, and it was the panic of that moment that made these solutions politically acceptable. And Poland still has just shockingly high unemployment levels because of these policies.
Next email comes from Greg in Plano, and he writes, the U.S. government, with its food aid policies overseas, deliberately ensures that all food aid must be purchased directly from the U.S. How does this fit into your shock doctrine theory?
Well, this is certainly one of the most common criticisms of the aid industry, that so much of it actually goes to subsidize the companies and the industries in the donor countries. One of the things that I've been looking at right now in terms of recent examples of the shock doctrine in action, in addition to the oil crisis, we're seeing the food crisis as an opportunity for the agribusiness companies to push through their wish list. And some of it takes the form of food aid, which is nothing new. It's essentially a demand for a subsidy to local agriculture companies, and then the food is shipped to countries like Haiti, Liberia. But the other thing we're seeing is a real push now for the elimination of laws that bar genetically modified crops in many parts of the world, and really trying to sell GMOs as the solution to the food crisis. And this is as much of a false promise as the idea that offshore oil drilling is going to lower the price at the pump. There's absolutely no scientific evidence that GMOs increase crop yields. But once again, it's a very concerted attempt to use a crisis, to use the desire for a quick fix solution to push the wish list of an industry that has limitless funding for lobbying.
So let's talk about why the agriculture industry would want GMOs. Part of it is because many of those items are patented, and they can, once they've started to be grown somewhere, that's pretty much all that people can grow.
Well, it is simply a much more profitable agricultural model for companies like Monsanto, and this is because if you don't have GMOs, farmers save their seeds from one year to the next and replant them, which is good for the farmers but not good for the companies that are selling the seeds. It's much more profitable if farmers are forced to buy seeds year after year, because they are the intellectual property for those seeds are owned by an outside company like Monsanto. There was an incredible piece in Vanity Fair a couple of months ago about the levels of harassment and legal harassment and surveillance that American farmers are under by the big agriculture companies, particularly Monsanto, over seed swapping and seed saving.
So how do we make sure that aid gets where it needs to go without disaster capitalists sort of taking over the process?
Well, there are some really great NGOs who are trying to come up with solutions to this problem and to try to extract themselves from the disaster capitalism industry and make themselves more accountable to the people who in whose name they work and in whose name they fundraise. And I think it's a really healthy impulse. The NGO that I've really been impressed with most in this area is called ActionAid International. ActionAid International, they have an office in Washington, also London, around the world. They're the ones who've actually done the best research about how much aid money is what they call phantom aid, meaning it stays in the countries in the donor countries, as opposed to reaching the countries, the recipient countries. They're the ones who've been really breaking down these numbers: how much money goes to consultants, how much money goes to domestic firms, and so on. ActionAid has been organizing these great encounters between community organizers in different disaster zones so that they can exchange ideas and strategies and talk about what is really needed. And what's really needed is our mechanisms of accountability between the NGOs and the people who've been affected by wars, by natural disasters, so that when you raise billions of dollars for reconstruction from the next disaster, the people who have been affected have a say in how their communities are rebuilt and in what sort of economic development they have. They make sure that communities aren't pitted against each other. There's a democratization process within the communities so that aid organizations can't play favorites. There's a list of demands that has been emerging, and we actually posted some of the minutes from these meetings on our website, shockdoctrine.org. You can also get to it from my website, naomiklein.org. And I feel like we're almost at the early stages of a new civil rights movement, of a survivors' rights movement, which will build in accountability. And I think there's a lot of great aid workers out there working for groups like Oxfam that will really embrace this. I hope they do, because I think that their credibility really relies on it. I don't think we want to get cynical about the idea that we can help in an emergency. It's a profoundly human impulse. We want to do it, but we want to know that when we send money, it certainly reaches the people who inspired that giving, and certainly doesn't hurt them, which is what we're seeing far too often.
So in the interest of not being too cynical, do you think it's possible for a for-profit company to invest in a region that has been devastated and still accept some conditions that would make sure that the people who are in that region are not being taken advantage of?
Absolutely. Let's think about New Orleans. I mean, New Orleans, after Katrina, could have been a city that was rebuilt according to a kind of Green New Deal vision. Because, of course, what happened in New Orleans was not just a natural disaster. It came out of a collision between increasingly heavy weather, which is linked to climate change, of course, and weak infrastructure, neglected infrastructure. And this was a city that had so many problems before Katrina hit, in unemployment, in decaying public infrastructure, public transit, public schools. So then all of this money was released, and of course, much of that money should have gone to the private sector. But the vision for that reconstruction should have come from the people of New Orleans themselves. And because it's taxpayer money that we're talking about, any conditions that the public would like to attach to that money could be attached. So people could have said, you have to hire the locals from New Orleans. The people who have been displaced need to be the people who get these jobs, and they need to pay a living wage. So it's the issue is not public versus private. The money is public. The money is taxpayer money, and it is going to go into private hands, much of it, but it can go into private hands in the interest of the public, and there are all kinds of conditions that can be attached, which are the opposite of the kind of conditions that the Bush administration attached. If we remember, the very first thing that the Bush administration did after Hurricane Katrina was suspend Davis-Bacon, which is the federal contracting law that says that contractors have to pay the prevailing wage in the region in which they are rebuilding. And under pressure, the Bush administration had to rescind that and reinstate Davis-Bacon. But by then, a huge amount of hiring had already taken place.
Naomi Klein's latest book is just out in paperback. It's called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. You can learn more about her work online at naomiklein.org. Naomi, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.